Good evening, everyone. Always evening here in Italy, while who knows what time it is, where you are, because we're all over the world. So thank you for listening in. This is Patricia Corey. The show is Beyond the Matrix, for people who dare to think outside the box of convention. And I've got some announcements before I go into the show. The first is a reminder that this will be the last Sunday that I'm broadcasting to you. I'll now be moving to Thursdays so that I can reach more people and so that I can have a normal weekend. So please tune in on Thursdays now, 12 o'clock California time. And I've decided to add a little beginning announcement to every show. It's going to be a moment of sanity. So before I bring on my wonderful guest, we're going to have a moment of sanity. This moment of sanity is about the latest freak out, desperate scarcity mentality that is sweeping the media, and it's about the food shortage scare. In fact, I think a couple of days ago, New York, Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal came out with an article that said this is not a drill, it is time to stockpile food. And I react to this and would like to share with you a few ideas. Number one, let's get out of scarcity and into abundance. I don't know anyone in our Western societies personally that is starving. And although there are people starving in the world, we do what we can to assist the other. But in our own lives, let's get balanced and grounded in reality. I doubt anyone who's listening to this show has ever experienced starvation. Stockpiling food is going to lead to buying mass quantities of food that are going to go bad, and you're going to have to dump, and it's going to be the biggest joke on you in a long time. So please, please, please don't buy into this. Don't send around emails about the scarcity and the fear. Send out messages about how to create abundance. For example, if the problem is a lack of food, get out there and plant some fresh vegetables. Do a sharing with your neighbors. Come on, let's get creative here, folks, okay? Follow happiness. That is my moment of sanity for the hour. Okay, tonight's guest is a wonderful author and brilliant thinker. His name is Dr. Bob Curran. He's got a wonderful book out called Lost Lands and Forgotten Realms, and it is my pleasure. I tell you what, we're going to have a really fun hour because we're going to be talking about vanished cities and kingdoms that history misplaced with a historian and folklore expert, Dr. Bob Curran, who is in... Where are you, Dr. Bob?
I am in Northern Ireland, Patricia.
Northern Ireland. Talk about a land steeped in the mystic.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for being on tonight. I'm really delighted to have you on, and I know that people are going to have a great time with you tonight.
I hope so. It's a pleasure to be here, Patricia.
Thank you. I've got to ask you now. I've seen you've got some pretty interesting titles, books that I will read. This is the first one that's come across to me. So can you just give us an idea of how you have become so involved in the question of mystical lands, and this is a subject that is very near to my heart.
Well,
so
Patricia,
how did this book come about?
Well, Patricia, I grew up in a very remote area of Ireland. I am here in the north, and I grew up in a mountain country, and we were very remote. And the traditions and beliefs of former years were still very important and very prized among the people who I grew up among. You asked about lost lands and vanished realms. The idea has always been with me, as I suspect it has been with you. I would live in a very remote area, and from time to time, people would come back. You know, they'd been away to all sorts of places, and We didn't travel all that far. If you could see the gray in my beard, you'd know that this was about the 1940s and 1950s. You sound far too young to remember that.
Oh, you're too kind. I don't have a beard, but you can be sure there's plenty of gray area.
But people would come back, and they would come back from places like England, and some of them would come back from America, and some people would come back from Italy. And they would tell wonderful stories of what was going on. And as a small boy, I listened to all these stories, and I think that they impressed me very, very much. And,
so you were privileged to be one of the people that was getting the oral story, the storytellers coming through.
The tradition in this part of the world, Patricia, was almost completely oral. There were a number of people, and this is not to disrespect them at all, who could not neither read nor write. And so their tradition was completely oral. And they were a repository of great stories, of great interpretations, and that's how I got into all these things, because these people nowadays are not all that much valued. I mean, a lot of our culture and interpretation comes through television and stuff, and you were saying at the start of your show where people through the internet and are sending out emails and they are shaping a reality for themselves. But we, in our part of the world, we grew up with a different sort of reality. And I wanted to celebrate the notion of people traveling, of people interpreting the world for themselves, and creating their own sense of identity and their own sense of a world for themselves.
I think this is really so sad that the children are losing that function of the brain, which is creating the illusion and the imagery from the story, rather than having it blasted out of them from every kind of electronic screen.
I would agree with you totally.
And I think that it's a sad state of affairs that... I'm imitating your accent already.
Don't worry about that.
It's a sad state of affairs.
Don't worry about that. We are creating our own reality between us. So,
you can hear me. I'm very giddy at talking to you. I have a lot of joy and bubbly energy from you, which is wonderful for me and for
sure
for
okay.
The people that are listening. So
that's okay. Go ahead.
Back to the book. I would like to ask you, there's so many places that come to mind and that you talk about. I mean, you don't just limit yourself to the British Isles, but needless to say, what a place. It just seems like Britain and Ireland, the veils are so thin between, let's call it, I usually refer to this as dimensions, but whatever, between
okay.
the realms.
Okay.
And I would love to first start asking you about Brigadoon. What's the deal with Brigadoon?
Well, now, part of this, Patricia, is how we create our own reality. If you look at the back of the book, you'll see that I'm, one of my degrees is in psychology. So I bring a psychological aspect to the notion. And from part of the time, we look back towards a sort of fantastical time in the past. And I don't know about you, Patricia, but sometimes I've been walking down the street, and the life seems so complicated, so full of all sorts of things, that we turn to ourselves and say, wouldn't it be great if life was a bit less complicated and it was a bit like the way it used to be? And we
I think everyone's feeling that way at the moment, aren't they?
Absolutely. And we project that back into what we call the good old days. The good old days.
The good old days.
The good old days. And we say, you know, there was a time before the present day when life was much better. And wouldn't it be great if that could appear from time to time and just salve us, if you like, or make life easier for us? And I think Brigadoon is part of that, because everything in Brigadoon is very, very nice. And it is from a world that has passed. It is, and I don't like using this word, but it is quaint. It fulfills a lot of our desires and a lot of our imagery of past times. So perhaps that Brigadoon was actually based not on a village in Scotland, but actually on a village in Germany, which was supposed to reappear from time to time, and peace and tranquility and all would flow out from that, and a kind of happiness and stuff like that. So we're beginning to look back. In some ways, it fulfills our longings and our aspirations towards, as many of these ancient realms did.
But so your slant from that answer seems to be that these are potentially aspects of the mind where we wish to escape. Yeah.
Not altogether. I mean, there are.
Good, because I was going to ask you about how do you feel about the merging dimensions and the veil lowering and this aspect of reality that seems to be shifting so dramatically for us all?
I think that you have a sort of interpretation. I mean, we're talking about some of these ancient realms, and we're looking at how it can be interpreted, how the world around us is interpreted. And we look at, for instance, in a sunken land, we were talking about how things were much better in past times. We're talking about, let's say, a sunken land like Atlantis. Now, whenever I was growing up in the 1950s, Atlantis was supposed to be the epitome of wealth, of civilization. It was beneficent. It was wonderful. Now, if Atlantis did exist, and we go back to the writings of Plato and Solon on this, Atlantis was, if it did exist, was not like that at all. It lay, says Plato, beyond the Pillars of Hercules. It was a civilization which was based on slavery. It was a militaristic civilization, and it was a naval civilization which attacked all other civilizations all around the Mediterranean. And so it may well have been, of course, the Minoan civilization, which was actually based in the Mediterranean, based around the island of Santorini, which was destroyed
by a volcano.
Right, but
you said it was beyond the Pillars of Hercules.
Well, some say that was beyond the Pillars of Hercules. Some people say it wasn't. Again, whenever I was growing up in the South American jungle, there was supposed to be a fabulous city called El Dorado, which was...
That was going to be one of my questions.
The city of gold. El Dorado, of course, does not refer to a city, but actually to a man. The name means the gilded man, and may have been come from a notion that chieftains among the Mesoamerican tribes smeared themselves with gold powder, and as a sign of their wealth and as a sign of their status. But El Dorado became this fabulous city somewhere in the jungle, and it became almost an aspiration to. So in answer to your question, Patricia, there might be some elements of truth, and I think in the book there are some elements of truth in that, but part of it is our interpretation. Some of it is how we feel about things, and perhaps that answers your question, where we look towards a veil which can be lifted. The veil may be spiritual, the veil may be psychological, the veil may be whatever.
Even physical.
Last week.
I had Dr. Michio Kaku on. What a genius. And we were talking about all kinds of incredible things, hyperspace, people
yeah.
that are walking
Absolutely.
In one dimension and people bumping into them in the physical realm, not seeing them at all. And we were really out there, I'll tell you. So yeah. We are privileged to live in a moment when anything goes as far as
We do. And remember that we only see in a certain number of dimensions. So there may well be, if we could see ourselves in another way, we would be surprised. I have read some where we appear as triangles. So anything is possible.
Well, that's really funny that you said that, because I work with the Therians as a, well, I won't go into that at the moment, but triangles are very important to me vibrationally, so that's a nice
Absolutely.
Little link you made for me. I just went
right.
back to Atlantis for a minute. You said Atlantis was anything but idyllic, and I just wanted to suggest that it wasn't necessarily in many, potentially many thousands of years that Atlantis could have existed. It may be that the last generations were not idyllic, but that they had their high culture as well.
That may be the case, because we do know that many ancient civilizations, for instance, the Babylonians and the early Egyptians, were greatly advanced. The Babylonians had batteries and various other heating things, you know, implements. And in the latter days, as happens in many civilizations, you only can think of the great Roman civilization,
right.
that became corrupted and fell by the wayside, if you like. So
well, it seems
may
to be
well
the cycle of societies that we build and then we destroy what we build, and this is
that's exactly
nature.
Right.
So you can
quote example after example on that.
Yeah, that's why there seems to be some confusion about Atlantis, because on the one hand, we have an almost innate sense that this was a real land and that it was the greatness. And then on the other, the destruction and the abuse of power. And the answer for me is that, sure, why is it hard to believe that this could have been a land that survived tens of thousands of years?
Well, this is true, but a part of it is, and we begin to look, and you're asking, and people ask me, well, where was Atlantis? And Atlantis seems to shift, as you were saying, beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which are the Straits of Gibraltar, and out, which would put it out towards Britain or Ireland. Some people say no, it was in the Mediterranean, and there is the evidence for the great volcanic explosion at Santorini, and it was probably part of the Minoan civilization, which flourished in that area, and we do know that a civilization flourished in that area. And
right,
other people say...
It's also
sorry?
Probable that it was a huge continent, which is what I believe, that went from the north
well
down to the
have,
south
yeah.
of America.
Yeah, it may well have been. We know not enough about the early civilizations. And it may be that it is unrecorded, and there are traces of it, it is said, in some of the very early civilizations within America. And
in
it's
fact,
thought that survivors from Atlantis may have landed in America.
Well, my theory is that a huge continent existed between the Africa and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And Canada and North America and South America, this continent
mm-hmm.
Atlantis. And it would have
well
made it
be.
Very simple, potentially very close between the continents to create a lot of access. Because we've got quite some quota, we've got all of the myth of the white man, bearded man coming.
As Quetzalcoatl, that's right.
Yeah.
And we do find that. And we find that not only in early American, but also in other, for instance, in Japan, we find myths of white bearded men and things like that. So, I mean, we do have, Atlantis could have stretched for a greater part of the world.
All right. So, I guess what I'm going to ask you now is, so do you believe that Atlantis was a real culture?
And the answer which I'm going to give you, Patricia, is both yes and no.
I knew it! I knew, no! I wasn't going to
give you a philosopher's answer. That is the ultimate philosopher's answer. Yes, Atlantis may well have existed, and I think there is evidence for a very ancient civilization like Atlantis. But it is also projected part of our own aspirations and interpretations of the ancient world. As I said earlier, our own notions of the ancient world are still developing.
Yes,
the ancient world was very, very different from what we believe it to be, I would suspect. And we're only beginning to reach an understanding of it now. So we have to, we have projected, I think, a lot of our own aspirations, our own perceptions, our own interpretations into something which is probably very different from what we imagine it to be.
Indeed. Well, there's no question that humanity is in search of
absolutely
something to some aspect that reminds us of the greatness of the human spirit.
I think so. And I think some of these lost lands, for instance, one of the things whenever you're talking, I'm thinking of Shangri-La, which was supposedly a mythical kingdom or a kingdom which existed in the Himalayas and was supposed to be the place of ultimate tranquility and peace. And now, part of that may be, once again, like Atlantis, part of that may have been an actual Himalayan kingdom. Some of our hopes and aspirations have gone into that, and it became very much to the fore in the film, the 1937 film, Lost Horizon, which actually brought it to the wider public. So we're beginning to look at our hopes and aspirations and towards a time of great, or a place of great tranquility, and maybe a better time than the complicated time we sometimes live in.
Can I interject something here?
You can indeed. Go ahead.
When I was in Tibet in 1997, which fortunately I brought myself there then.
Yep.
I was in the Potala Palace, and there was in a remote, really remote area in the Potala Palace, I found a stand, a beautiful walnut-looking stand with a huge glass dome, and inside this dome was the most intricately carved-looking little city. It looked like it was carved out of balsa wood.
Mm-hmm.
It was just so intricate. It was villages and little roads and whatever, and there was a little label on the glass, and it said Shambhala.
Shambhala.
And I was flabbergasted to see that this had been important enough for the monks or the lamas to have created this intricate design.
Yeah.
It was like a city map.
Yeah. Shambhala, of course, was sought after, as was Shangri-La, by a number of people. The most famous, of course, being Madame Blavatsky. Madame Blavatsky, for those of you who don't, those of your listeners who don't know, was the founder of Theosophy, and was in, she claimed, direct contact with the Grand Masters who lived in Tibet. And she believed that there was a place called Shangri-La and Shambhala.
Mm-hmm.
Shambhala was a wonderful city where there was peace and harmony.
Some people, I'm one of them, believe that there are some of the greatest masters in the planet that are still bringing wisdom out to us.
That is undoubtedly the case, but it was also sought after by the Nazis, who thought that it might be the birthplace of the Aryan or master race, there was certainly expeditions, one led by Ernest Schaeffer around about the early 1930s. He couldn't find the city, but he did. He was a botanist, and he did find all sorts of wonderful plants, which he brought back.
And his name was Ernest Schaeffer.
That was Schaeffer. The other gentleman who went to look for it in 1939 was Heinrich Herrer. Now, Herrer actually went as far as, I think, Lhasa. But
he was sent by Hitler, wasn't he?
He was sent by Hitler. That's right.
Yeah.
Because they believe Hitler had a feeling that this was the birthplace of the Aryan race, and that there was sacred wisdom which would enable him to win the Second World War. Herrer had been sent in 1939, before war had been actually declared.
Right.
And he, I think he wrote the book 7 Years in Tibet, which
I've got that book.
Yep. There have been many quests. Now,
but don't forget Admiral Byrd.
There was Admiral Byrd as well. And
Admiral Byrd this is documented stuff. He just ended up somewhere in the middle of the planet, right?
That may be the case, yes. But
consider that he was a military pilot, and so although the story has it that he was told to shut up about what he saw, he did report that he was flying over the Arctic, and
that's
at one
right.
point his equipment went berserk, and he was suddenly in a lush tropical environment where he saw mammoth elephants, right?
He had seen what he believed to be a lost world, and he is supposed to have, if I remember correctly, because there have been a number of similar stories, that he had met with wonderful beings who lived, and they were corresponding to the people who might inhabit some sort of idyllic paradise like Shangri-La. We talk about Shangri-La, and over here, I don't know what it's like over where you are, but we talk about Shangri-La. I'm beginning to lift your accent, Manny.
we're gonna juxtaposition personalities. I'm gonna start talking like you.
We talk about Shangri-La, and over here, Shangri-La is one of the most used names for people's homes when they retire, and I think that feeds into the notion of contentment and quiet, and may well have been put out by Frank Capra's film on Lost Horizon, which was about finding Shangri-La after a plane crash.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, hold on a minute. I just want to announce your name again, because sometimes people come in not at the beginning. I have with me wonderful Dr. Robert Curran, who I'm calling Dr. Bob. And
that's
the book is Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, and we're talking about sunken continents, vanished cities, and the kingdoms that history misplaced. So thank you for tuning in. Dr. Bob, do you have a website that people can go to?
Unfortunately, at the moment, I'm getting one built, so it should be up and running before the end of the year. Unfortunately, I'm backwards and forwards, and we're trying to get the website up and running.
Okay, but anyway, your book is available in all the bookstores, right?
Oh, it is, and it's available on Amazon and things like that.
Lost Lands, it's called.
Yep.
All right, so let's go back to where we were. You were talking about how in Ireland... there's such a particular openness to the concept of Shangri-La, at least using the term Shangri-La.
Well, there
no
is.
Question about it, that, you know, so much myth and mystery and magic come out of Ireland. It must be quite remarkable to have grown up in that environment?
Well, I come from Ireland, and as I was saying at the very start, Patricia, I grew up in a very remote area. Now, what we might term today as superstition, that is the belief in something which lies beyond yourself. I was very, very strong and very, very valued. I suppose that has come down within me because is reflected in this book, because I can probably reveal to you that I was standing at my sink whenever, looking out from my kitchen window whenever I got the idea for this book, and I was looking across into the old, from my kitchen window, I can see the oldest inhabited, continuously inhabited, place in Ireland. And that is Mount Sandal Fort, which is 7,000 BC. And that's the site that greets me whenever I open my kitchen blinds in the morning. And perhaps there was something, and I was looking across and I said, there is a place, and it is not, the local councils here do not value it greatly. I mean, they value a shopping mall or something much more than that, because it's commercial and because it's making them money. And I said, people have almost forgotten that. And it's about time we wrote, and it's about time we valued our traditions. And I'm not only speaking of America, I'm speaking of Ireland, because we were talking at the very start about people telling stories. These are now vanishing here, even in Ireland. And we're talking about Ireland is a very mystical, and people are very open to that. And yes, that is that has been the case. People are now shutting down. I mean, yes. I would teach, and most of my pupils who are quite young, some of whom are quite young, would be able to tell me much more about High School Musical and Pokemon rather than they could tell me about the traditions and beliefs of Ireland.
Well, sure, because there's not enough access to the stories, and because the mind is losing. Our brains are being directed into working with other functions, like a computer, which is the logic. You push a button, you want the image. You've got the data. You push a button, you get the image that has been created to go with that piece of data. And that part of the brain, that the mind, expressive, creative self, doesn't have a chance to create its own image.
I think what you're saying, Patricia, is absolutely correct. And the way in which we frame up the world has changed. And we now look for, and you're quite right, we now look for very pat and very easy access to the answers to the questions which we put out. And we want everything laid on a plate for us, because that's what we are now becoming used to. I mean, as you say, we press a button, the answer comes up. And we tend to frame up the world much more in a scientific way. We begin to look for what we might term, and put it in inverted commas, as rational explanations for things like that. So our the way I would frame it up is that our mindset has changed very subtly.
No, the way that I would frame it up is that we're starting to observe the world in bites and make a bite
we
and
are,
kill a
yeah.
bite.
You're absolutely right, and you're quite so that whenever you press a button, the answer comes up, or whenever you ask a question, you need a specific answer. And that
let me interject that this is the in many ways debilitating to the intelligence, because
absolutely.
Monkeys can do this. We can train monkeys
absolutely.
To push the button to get the banana.
Absolutely. But that is the society we're evolving into. And I think our ancestors, and certainly here in Ireland, our ancestors recognized the world as much more complex and full of all sorts of undercurrents, if you like, in which there was all sorts of different explanations for things. Now, we, sitting back in this mindset and with our sort of civilized viewpoint, tend to look on these things as superstition and goodness, it's silly how silly our ancestors were believing and all. But the interpretations were fitted well in with the time in which they were done, and possibly much more took greater validation of the complexity of the world around us. That it was
we have to remember also that our ancestors were much more close to nature. So I can believe that they were in contact with the spirit realm far more than we are.
That was the other thing which I was going to say, because we depend so, we have come to depend so heavily upon technology, this has framed up our views of the world. And you're quite right. For instance, here in Ireland, the ancient Celts believed that they had actually emerged from the land. Whenever an ancient king in the Celtic tradition, became king, he actually had to put his foot in a carved footprint in the ground to show that he was one with the land over which he ruled. And you will find instances of these both here in Ireland, and in fact there's one not too far away from me, and over in Scotland as well, because it was a tradition of the Celtic kings in Scotland. And this gave a sort of connection with the land. Now, no king could rule here on if he had a blemish on his face or on his body, because that would then transfer into the land. So Conn of the Hundred Battles, whenever he lost an eye, had to give up the throne and could not
rule.
So
that blemish would transfer into the earth?
It would. It would. And it would affect his people. And the people were all united through the land, and you're quite right, spirits and the interpretations of what was happening were all done through the countryside and the landscape all around. In some parts of the in some parts of Ireland, it hasn't completely vanished. I mean, people will still ask you, what's that down there, or what, and there's old tombs and old rafts and stuff like that, and people will still not touch them, but now, in the last 10-20 years, people are now flattening these places in order to build modern homes or blocks of flats or whatever you want.
Yeah. Some people believe that there's a concerted effort to deliberately break the energy of the sacred places.
I would think so, yes. And these places, and I would agree with you, Patricia, that these people or these places have been sacred or important to the people for centuries beforehand.
It empowers the people, and if you really believe in a conspiracy, then you know you can get out on a limb and think, okay, so these energies are being deliberately broken to disempower the people, which is that this is what's happening.
In many cases, and it not only empowered the people, but it gave them a sense of their identity and their worth on the world.
Well, that is empowering.
And that is empowering. But
I'm just back from Egypt, and I'm writing a new book about Egypt, in fact. And in the book, I talk about how I walk out onto the sand, and I'm on the Giza Plateau back in '97. And now you can't. There's a wall completely around the pyramid.
That's right.
And these walls are going up around all of the great monuments in the world, even in Mexico.
Well, here in Ireland, here in the north, there were a great deal of ancient sites which were simply eradicated for political reasons, because this was not to give a certain section of the community a notion of their identity. I mean, they were English, let's say, and not Irish, because this place had been colonized by the English.
Right.
And so old rocks which had existed, there actually is, behind where I'm talking to you, the site of an old rock, which was very important, which was simply leveled to make way for a new dual carriageway or highway.
And what do you think about the news that they're trying, or I don't know what the latest is, but the rumor has it that they're going to dig under the under Stonehenge in order to extend the road under there?
They are. Not only that, they are going to, here in Ireland, they are going to put a new two-lane highway through the ancient site of Tara. There are plans for that. There are also in County Cork, because I've been working with some of the McCarthys down there, there are also plans to put through the hill of the Puka, Carrick Fuga, and through an ancient, level an ancient stone circle that is there, so that you can get greater access from the west to the Shannon Airport.
But they're going to definitely do this, drilling under Stonehenge?
I had to write a letter to the Irish Minister of Development. Now, it's changing now that Bertie Ahern is leaving. Reminding him about the ancient the ancientness of the place, its special place, and it was a seat of the McCarthys, and a very, very ancient clan, and the Lady McCarthy is still alive and still living in the castle, and the motorway or the throughway from the airport will go straight past her front door. So I received a letter back from the minister and said that he would take note of all this, but one never knows.
But you know, as you're saying this, I'm thinking to myself, so these places will be the lost lands and the forgotten realms.
These will become the lost. You're absolutely right, Patricia. These will become the lost lands.
Will say of us, they say that there used to be a place called Stonehenge.
Absolutely. And we're laughing at it, but that will become possibly the case in which my father-in-law, my wife's father, had an old pamphlet which he showed me, which showed this old rock, and he says nobody knows where that is now. I mean, they say that there was an old rock in this area which was hung with garlands and stuff on certain, and that was destroyed by Protestants because it was considered to be a Catholic thing. Mm-hmm. And it is now the site of a two-lane highway.
It's amazing how what a good job religions have done of destroying tradition.
Well, absolutely. You'll find this all over the north. I mean, I do a lot of history stuff, and I can take you to the sites of here and there and everywhere, and old abbeys and old stones and stuff like that, all of which are gone, and you have to stand in the middle of a field and say at one stage there was an abbey here, or at one stage there was a stone circle here, but the farmers have taken it away. And that becomes... So, yes, in a sense, lost lands and forgotten realms are all around us and are becoming even more important because they are vanishing.
Yeah, this is why I organize sacred journeys. I've been doing this for about 3 years now because I think that it's so urgent for people to get to the sacred sites. And it's such a celebration when we go, and I just know that, I just feel that it's one of the most important things you can do with your life at this time.
Absolutely. The other thing which is vanishing is, very recently, if I can mention this on the air, I brought out another book which recorded some of the old tales, which were the old tales, the old stories of people connected with various parts of the countryside.
Mm-hmm.
Because the storytellers, and we were talking about this slightly earlier, the stories and the beliefs are all disappearing. And I have a suspicion that this will be one of the last generations which will be able to record those stories, because I'm coming into areas and I'm talking about the things, and I said, look, what's that down there? And they said, we don't know. And but if you'd been here 2 or 3 years ago, there was an old guy lived up the road, and he would have been able to tell you exactly what this was. And so the repositories of local knowledge, or as we call them, the Shanachie, the men and women of lore, are vanishing. Now, like snow off a ditch, and within a generation, we will not be able to see their like again.
I'm hopeful because I am the optimist that this is because we are moving into a new understanding where we will be able to receive more than just these markers.
Well,
I do believe that it's all in the ethers and that these realms are merging.
I also
believe that there is no past and no future.
I think you're right, Patricia, because I'm in some areas I'm beginning to see, if you like, the green shoots beginning to reemerge again. And there, in local community groups with whom I work, there are notions of storytelling, there are notions of preserving places.
Yeah.
It is, at this moment in time, I don't know what it's like in the States, but at this moment in time over here, it is almost an uphill battle. You know, you're looking against corporate people, you're looking against developers who have a specific agenda, things like that. But I think that gradually communities are now, certainly here in Ireland, becoming slightly aware of, more aware of themselves, and beginning to form into groups, and I work with them, and we begin to develop their history and develop their interpretations of the past. And to me, if they can produce stuff, then that is all to the good and will encourage the notion, those notions which you're talking about, returning in the world.
It seems that in many cases in history, the human race has had to be pushed to the limits before it gets out of the comfort zone. And I think we are at the limits, and we're starting to see society globally. People are starting to call upon the governments and say, okay, it's enough now. And I do believe we're at the point of a great revolution on this planet.
I think so.
Which is one of the reasons why the powers that be want to take away the structures that empower us.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But ha-ha, never underestimate the greatness of the human spirit.
Because remember that's where the big institutions, the corporate, the financial, all have their centers of power. And I think that with the notion of increasing environmental issues and global warming and things which we are going to have to take into account anyway, that will be, as you quite rightly say, a push which will push mankind back towards thinking about much deeper truths which lie almost forgotten.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we have to get pushed to those limits, but nonetheless, I do think that we are getting pushed to those limits, and we are already beginning to see a response from the greater human race. I think we're moving out of this dark time.
Well, I would.
Let's hope I'm right.
I'm putting my money on you, Patricia. So
oh, thank you, Doctor.
It better be right.
That's true. So one question I wanted to go to, and I've kind of drifted away, was I'd like to ask you to talk about Avalon, because I
Avalon.
Do bring people there a lot, and it's such a mystical place. And from your point of view, and from the point of view of the book, what can you tell us about Avalon?
Well, I take it you have been to Glastonbury.
Yes, and in fact, I'll be back there in July.
And this was supposed to be one of the centers where Arthur was buried. Remember that Avalon? And the name simply means the Isle of Apples, and there were a number of ancient myths throughout the ancient world, or ancient stories throughout the ancient world, which involved apples. Apples were, of course, the symbol of the fruition of man, of reproduction, of fecundity, of abundance.
Mm-hmm.
And Avalon simply means the Isle of Apples. The ancient garden of the Hesperides, as well as the apple with which Eve tempted Adam, which comes out of the biblical tradition, which has a certain agenda to it. But certainly appears in a number of ancient texts. So this was the Isle of Avalon was supposed to be where the great king, once in future King Arthur, was taken when he was killed at the battle of, or was dying at the Battle of Camelon. Camelon in the north of England. It was also supposed to be the place where Joseph of Arimathea came to when he left the Holy Land, and he brought certain treasures from the Christian tradition to Avalon. So you had both early Celtic, and you had also a Christian tradition in that.
But it was believed that this was a land that was in the mist.
Sorry?
It was believed that Avalon was in the mist. You had to travel through the mist.
That was the other thing, yes. That Avalon was a place where you traveled through in order to reach the other world. That was an ancient Celtic belief. You traveled, this was where Arthur was taken, so that he could progress to the Celtic Otherworld. Now, the Celtic Otherworld was a place, very unlike, our conception of heaven, or hell, or whatever you want, to think about. Nowadays, we think, whenever we die, this ceases our involvement in the world. The ancient Celts believed rather differently. They believed that you passed through a number of places and to the other world, which was never completely specified, but in which you could watch what was going on in the world. And if you wanted, you could come back and intervene in the affairs of the world. So Avalon was a place where Arthur was taken to await almost his transfer to the other world, where he would lie in wait until England or Britain or whatever was in trouble again, and he would return.
So he could see the world, the three-dimensional world, from this place.
They could, and this was quite common. I remember whenever I was growing up, people in my part of the world used to set on Halloween night, or we called it Hallow Eve night, a place for people at the table for people who returned from the dead. And I well remember an old woman spreading the fine ash from her fire on the hearthstone, and if it was disturbed in the morning, the dead had come back and had a dance on her hearthstone.
Now that is amazing, and I have to make a segue on that comment and ask you if you will come back to my show, because we're out of time.
I would be delighted, Patricia.
I have never ever done this show where I've looked at the clock and said, oh my gosh, we're out of time. You have been absolutely captivating.
It was a pleasure talking to you, and I will be pleased to come back.
Okay, no, really, because we've only scratched the surface of Lost
we
Land
have.
Forgotten Realm.
We have indeed. But
one question
I hope
before I sign out, and that is this. Were I to bring some people to Ireland, would you come and talk to us?
It would be my pleasure, Patricia.
Oh, that would be fabulous.
You get in contact with me, and I will certainly do that.
That would be magnificent.
Not only that, but it would be my privilege to show you around some of the places here in the north.
Okay, that is a deal. With or without the group, will you still accept me? Because I'm an explorer.
Patricia, I am waiting for you even as we speak.
Ah, you're a darling, Dr. Bob. Listen, I've got to go, but my heart isn't in it. I have to tell you all that it's been a really fabulous hour with Dr. Bob Curran. What can I say? I feel like we're old friends, and I'm sure we've run into each other somewhere in some lost land, you know?
We will indeed. We will indeed.
You've been listening to Dr. Bob Curran. His book, his latest book, is Lost Land, Forgotten Realms. I see you've got some pretty interesting other books there, Dr. Bob.
We're
going to have you on more than one more time.
Whenever I come back, we'll talk about those as well. There's no problem with that, Patricia.
All right, we'll definitely have you back. Dr. Bob Curran, he's going to be seeing me in Ireland soon to learn the stories of the oral traditions and explore these incredible places. Thank you, Dr. Bob Curran. It has been a real delight, and thank you all for listening, and don't forget, get out of scarcity, get into abundance, and follow happiness. It's why we're here. We're supposed to make a miracle out of this lifetime. Okay, good night, everyone, and I remember now, Sundays are history. I'll be with you Thursdays, 12 o'clock California time. Good night, or good afternoon, or whatever. Have a great day. Bye-bye. Dr.